In this second hour of Focus, our guest is Joseph Ellis. He's an historian well known for writing about revolutionary America. He has authored a number of books about some of the founding fathers. He won the Pulitzer Prize for a book titled Founding Brothers. He's also author of another book, American Sphinx. That is a biography of Thomas Jefferson, and that won the National Book Award. This morning, we'll be talking about the subject of his most recent book, George Washington. He's author of a new biography titled His Excellency George Washington. It's published by Knopf, and it is out now in the bookstores. And as he explains in the preface to the book, what he has set out to do, what he is trying to do, is to take a figure that is at the same time both familiar and, to a lot of us, really unknown. George Washington, familiar in the sense that we recognize his image. It is on our currency. It is on Mount Rushmore. We have seen the statues and the paintings and Washington crossing the Delaware. The difficulty is taking those images and imagining this person, George Washington, as a real, living, breathing, flesh and blood human being. That is the challenge that he takes on in the book. And I just would like to read a little bit of the last paragraph of his preface, where he talks a little bit about the challenge of understanding the life of Washington. He writes, "It seemed to me that Benjamin Franklin was a wiser than Washington. Alexander Hamilton was more brilliant. John Adams was better read. Thomas Jefferson was more intellectually sophisticated. James Madison was more politically astute. Yet each and all of these prominent figures acknowledged that Washington was their unquestioned superior. Within the gallery of greats so often mythologized and capitalized as founding fathers, Washington was recognized as the foundingest father of them all." And then Mr. Ellis raises the question, why was that? He goes on to write, "In the pages that follow, I've looked for an answer, which lies buried within the folds of the most ambitious, determined, and potent personality of an age not lacking for worthy rivals. How he became that way and what he did with it is the story that I try to tell." As we talk this morning with our guest, Joseph Ellis, questions and calls are certainly welcome. We all only ask people to be brief when they call in so that we could keep the program moving and get in as many different people as possible. But of course, anyone's welcome to call. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Joseph Ellis, hello.
Hello, David. How are you? Hey, that quote sounded wonderful to me.
Yeah, pretty good writing, don't you think? we appreciate
it's
you getting your
It's a pleasure to be with you this morning.
Well, it is a fascinating subject, and certainly a challenge. And that is, I think probably any time that you talk about any of the men that you have mentioned, and I think that probably over time I've spoken with some writers who have written about others, and you and I talked, you probably don't remember, but you and I talked about American Sphinx, the challenge seems to be much the same. That is, we know these men from statues and from paintings mm-hmm. and from what we remember of the history that we got in school. And for any of them, it seems to be a big challenge to try to imagine them as real people. But of all of those, somehow, in the case of George Washington, it is even more difficult.
That's right. There's a real challenge with any of these people because there's a kind of electromagnetic field around them. They become mythologized. Nations probably need to create mythical heroes. Britain had King Arthur, and France had El Cid, and Rome had Romulus and Remus. But in each of those cases, those were fictional characters. These were real people, obviously imperfect. But the tendency, the interpretive tendency over the past 200 years has been either to make them into canonized saints, demigods, which they surely were not, or to go the other way, especially within the academy now, as the deadest, whitest males in American history, as the people who established racism, imperialism, patriarchy, and it's a kind of swoonish swing between those two extremes. We either want to idealize them and idolize them or else eviscerate them. And as is often the case in history, the truth lies at some other place, not in those two extremes. And I guess my own conviction for this book and other work I've done is that each of these creatures that we've mentioned in Washington too is imperfect, But taken together, they're the greatest collection of political talent that we've ever had. Apologies to Mr. Brokaw for Greatest Generation. He's talking about the entire generation. I'm talking about the leadership of the early republic here. And you're also right that I think Washington is the most prominent figure in American history about whom most Americans, including most well-read and well-educated Americans, know virtually nothing. And often what they know is wrong. Like he chopped down a cherry tree and then could not tell a lie. That itself is a lie, not told by Washington, but by his first popular biographer, a guy called Parson Weems, or that he had wooden teeth. They didn't have wooden teeth. He had these weird dentures, different sets at different times. At Mount Vernon now, that one of the sets of Washington's dentures is the most favorite tourist exhibit. The more people, you know, find that memorable. There's one gory story. In 1784, after the war, Washington is back at Mount Vernon, and a French dentist named Meilleur comes by and claims to be a specialist in implants. Now, you can imagine the level of dental science at that stage of time, but the gory part is, where do you get the teeth from? And the answer is from slaves. And Washington went down and paid slaves to have their teeth pulled so they could be put in his mouth. It eventually never took. Though by the time he was president, I think he still had some slave teeth in his mouth.
It seems that part of the challenge here of getting to understand Washington comes from his own reluctance to reveal himself. And I think you write something like that Washington was plenty willing to tell us those things that he did, but he wasn't really interested in telling us what he thought about what he had
done.
That's right.
He told Martha, his wife, to destroy their correspondence after he died, and she did that. So you don't have the kind of letters you have between Abigail and John Adams. And his diary, unlike, say, Adams's, which is a real, you know, emotionally honest discussion of his thoughts, even his feelings, Washington's diary is about the weather. And when he talks about which way the wind is blowing, he is not being metaphorical. So, for example, on the last day of his public life, May 6th, 1797, when he's stepping down from his second term as president, you go to his diary, and it says, you know, the date, and then it says, a day like all days, temperature 41 degrees Fahrenheit. Now, is that what he was really thinking? I don't think so, but he's not going to tell you what he's really thinking. And he's, therefore, a real challenge for a biographer. Washington's own ideas and convictions get shaped not by reading, so you can't go back to texts and see what he was as much as by experience. As a young soldier in the French and Indian War and then in the Revolution, so he is a more elemental figure. He is, as much as Franklin, by the way, a self-made man. He's not to the manor born. He's not a wealthy Virginian. He marries up. Martha is the wealthiest widow in Virginia when they marry in 1759, and that sort of catapults him to the top of the Virginia social hierarchy. But, I mean, one of the things that Mount Vernon's trying to do, they've brought in historians and anthropologists and graphic artists to try to create a historically authentic picture of what Washington looked like when he was a young man in his 20s. Because all of the images we have, as you mentioned, are those you know, those portraits done in the 1790s. There's a marvelous exhibit of those at the Met right now. And it's a kind of grandfatherly, iconic Washington. Whereas the young man is a physical specimen, 6'3 and a half, about 198 pounds. He's kind of like an action hero, a Jedi warrior, maybe like John Wayne circa 1939 in Stagecoach. Adams said we always chose Washington to lead us whenever we gathered together because he was the tallest man in the room. He's a head taller than the average American, who's 5'7 at that time. And he's 6'3 and a half. So that recovering the flesh and blood man in all his imperfections, in the end leads me to the conclusion it doesn't undermine his greatness. I mean, after all, if he was a demigod, we wouldn't have anything to learn from him, because none of us are.
No.
I really come away from the writing of the book thinking that he is the most prominent and the most important leader among the revolutionary generation, and perhaps in all of American history.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Joseph Ellis. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning historian, has authored biographies of the Founding Fathers, in fact, a book that looks at them as a group, titled Founding Brothers, and then also a biography devoted just to the life of Thomas Jefferson that won the National Book Award. He has a new book out that's a biography of George Washington. It's titled His Excellency George Washington, and it's published by Knopf. And questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. I think that it's interesting, you point out, and actually I think if you go back and you read some of the things that his contemporaries said about Washington, you do find people saying that he was a man of great passions. He was capable of great anger. He was a man who was ambitious. He was a man who had an ego, and that apparently he struggled to control that. Now, also, the things that people have said about him, his contemporaries, seem to make a point of saying that he was a master of his passions. And you seem to suggest that one key to perhaps understanding Washington is that he may have been a master of his passions, but that mastery was imperfect. And particularly when he was a younger man, there was a strong ego. There was perhaps almost a kind of a recklessness. And maybe that was something that he had to master and did to a large extent over his lifetime.
I think that you've got it right, at least as far as I'm trying to explain him, that there is this facade that he's able to put up and a kind of protective field around him. There's a story, it's probably apocryphal, but you'll see it in a lot of history books. At the Constitutional Convention, which Washington is presiding over, there's a moment of recess, and Alexander Hamilton goes up to another man called Gouverneur Morris, who's himself a terribly interesting character, a peg-legged guy, and says, "I dare you to go up to Washington, put your arm on his shoulder, and say, 'How you doing, George?'" And Morris takes up the bet and goes up to Washington, and Washington lifts his hand off his shoulder, Morris's hand, stares at him, and Morris backs away. And there's this interior space that he's not going to let very many people into. I think that part of his own aloofness is a conceit that permits him to disguise and to prevent from people from seeing how emotional and passionate he can be on occasion. In certain battles and during the war, he loses his temper when officers don't behave the way he wants to. Especially at Monmouth Courthouse, and one of the eulogies given right after Washington died, that same man that I mentioned earlier, Gouverneur Morris, describes as a man that anybody that knew him well had seen him lose his temper, and it was terrible. In cabinet meetings during the presidency, this is not a man that he has control of his passions, but his internal muscularity is just as impressive as his external muscularity in order to contain those passions. Some people can be composed and iconic easily because they don't have much inside to begin with, but he really did. He looked, from a certain point in his life onward, by the Revolutionary War for sure, everything he did was designed to make him the greatest hero in American history. And every word he wrote, he knew we would be reading later on. It makes it interpretively difficult because he's kind of posing for posterity. He wouldn't be surprised that he has the tallest monument in Washington, D.C. these days.
An awful lot is made of not only the heights to which he rose, the fact that he was the commander of the Continental Army, who was the first president of the United States, but also his not only his ability to achieve power, but his willingness to give it up, and the fact that,
right.
that after the war he resigned essentially as the commander of the army, and then after his second term, said that that was it. He was finished.
That's the two-term president.
Yeah.
It's an incredibly important part to understand Washington, because if you think of other revolutionary leaders in history, whether they were Caesar or Cromwell or later on Napoleon, Stalin, Mao, Castro, all of them believe that they and only they can embody the revolution, and they set up what becomes a despotic or totalitarian state in which they then rule as the equivalent of monarchs. And Washington was offered that opportunity when his army was at Newburgh, New York, right after the war, waiting to see the treaty Paris eventually concluded. He rejects it. He gives a famous speech to 500 officers, pulls a set of glasses out of his breast pocket, recently given to him by David Rittenhouse from Philadelphia. None of the officers had ever seen him wear glasses before. And he says, gentlemen, you must excuse me, but I have grown blind as well as gray in service to my country. We cannot repudiate the values that we've been fighting for by imposing some kind of despotism and monarchy on this new nation. And he then goes down to Annapolis to surrender his sword, and in this they have a ball in which there's all these ladies lined up to dance with him. He's a very good dancer, and he dances every dance, and a witness says they were all lined up to get a touch of him. Mm. I love that. He then has the horses waiting at the door, and he's off to Mount Vernon. They wave him off, and it's, in my judgment, the greatest exit in American history. But it is one of his greatest gifts is not how to exercise power. He's good at that, too, to be sure, but how to surrender it. Because he knows that the surrender, well, I think George III, when apprised that Washington would not accept the crown and was stepping away from power, said, if it's true, and if he does it, he'll be the greatest man in the world. Hmm. Well, he did, and he was.
We have a couple of callers to bring into our conversation in the nearby community of Belgium, and we'll go first to someone on line number 4. Hello.
Yes, hello.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'm not sure if this is true or not. This is information I got from actually a mystery book, but in this supposedly Washington during the French and Indian Wars, he was in the first battle against the French, and he led some kind of contingent of British forces against the French. Is this true? Do you know?
Yeah. It's the French and Indian War hasn't started, and there is a skirmish. It's not a full-scale battle. There's only like 30 people involved on each side. Washington is leading a group of Virginia militia and Native Americans, and they come upon a French contingent asleep in a place called Jumensville Glen in western Pennsylvania, not too far from modern-day Pittsburgh. And they ambush them, and in the ensuing struggle, the Indians, under a man called the Half King, whose Indian name is Tanacharasin, essentially massacre the wounded. And it's the first shot in the French and Indian War. And the French have epic poems they write about Washington in France and in Canada, making him a diabolical figure.
Great.
Who has launched this war. Washington isn't responsible for the massacre. It's a gory scene where the Half King walks up to the wounded Jumensville. Jumensville's trying to explain that he's on a diplomatic mission, but he's speaking French, and Washington can't understand French, but the Half King can understand French, and he realizes that they're going to surrender, and he's not going to get any scalps, and so he walks up to Jumensville, splits his skull down the middle with a tomahawk, washes his hands in his brain tissue, and then the Indians proceed to kill all the other wounded Frenchmen.
Wow.
all this under the horrified eyes of George Washington. He somewhat distorts the report on this back to the Virginia governor, whose name is Dinwiddie. So it's a kind of cover-up.
Okay.
All right.
So you're right. I'm giving you more detail than you might want, but that's true, and it's in the book.
Yeah. I love the detail.
Thank you.
Well, thanks for the call. Let's go on to someone else here. And actually, this caller is also in Belgium, line number one. Hello.
Yes, good morning, sirs. Interesting topic on the anniversary of the Boston Tea Party.
I didn't even know. I'm in Boston, by the way.
Oh, well, happy birthday.
Yeah. Washington, by the way, Washington said he wasn't, he didn't approve them to destroying all the tea, but he thought they were politically right.
The question I was wondering about is, Washington wanted a commission in the British Army, didn't he, at one time?
Yes, he did. He wanted it, and they refused it.
If he was such a, he refused it, they gave it to him.
No, they did not give it to him. He had a commission in the Virginia militia at the rank of colonel, and all the regular British officers said that that rank of colonel did not match a colonel in the British Army, and it was the equivalent of lieutenant. It's one of the things that he held against the British for the rest of his life, that they conducted themselves as if they were his superiors socially and that they were aristocrats and he was a mere provincial American. And Washington didn't think that Washington's response to that was not to say, oh, my God, I guess I'm not as good as them. His response was, these are idiots. I'm better than them. I know how to fight this kind of war against an Indian and French force better than they do. So he really did internalize a sense of hostility to the British Army because of the way they treated him.
I see. Thank you very much, sir.
All right. Thanks for the call. Other questions, again, are welcome. Our guest is Joseph Ellis. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning historian. He's the author of the book Founding Brothers. He is also the author of a biography of Thomas Jefferson, that book titled American Sphinx. It won the National Book Award. And a new book, His Excellency George Washington, a biography of Washington, and it's published by Knopf. And questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. I don't realize we're sketching out a number of major points, but I guess one of the things that comes to my mind, you do mention it, and it came up even in a conversation I was having with somebody about Washington the other day, was that given all of the action that he saw, all of the fighting that he saw, it's remarkable that he survived without some serious injury, you know, let alone being killed.
Oh, God, yeah. At the Battle of the Monongahela, right outside of Pittsburgh, along with General Braddock, he was part of a 2,000-man army that was marching on what was then called Fort Duquesne, which is Pittsburgh now, and they're ambushed by French and Canadian, French and Indians, and only 200 survive the 2,000-man force. And there's an Indian chief on the other side who claimed later that he had directed 17 of his braves to fire exclusively at Washington because they thought he was the commander because he was riding around on a horse. They had two horses shot out from under him. He had three bullet holes through his coat, one through his hat, one that creased his pants, and he was never scratched. And the Indian chief said he told them, his braves, to stop firing after a certain period of time, but the Great Spirit protected this man. And Washington, and there are similar stories during the Revolution at various battles. By all rights, he should have gone down at the Monongahela. He knew that. He used to go back to that story in his later years and in his letters. And it was one of those experiences that made him believe that somehow providence or destiny was on his side.
He was, for all the fact that we think of him as being the successful leader of the army in the Revolution, over his lifetime, I'm not sure that you would exactly say that he had been particularly successful in battle.
He was not a good tactician. Yeah. He he had only commanded a regiment before the war, before the Revolutionary War. During the French and Indian War, he commanded a 500-man regiment. But he was not good at moving troops over a larger battlefield where he couldn't see all of the players. He tended to develop tactical plans that were too complex and broke down. I mean, even at the successful crossing of the Delaware, there were supposed to be four columns going across the river. Three of them never made it across. He decided to risk it anyway. His greatness was not, and Howe and later Clinton outmaneuvered him in lots of different battles. Part of the problem was that the Continental Army was simply not capable of competing on equal terms with the professional British Army, which was the finest military force in the world. The great redeeming factor that makes all the other things meaningless is that he had the great strategic insight. And later, I mean, other generals, you know, like Robert E. Lee and Napoleon and Hannibal, never had this. He came to the realization that he did not have to win the war. The British had to win the war. And therefore, he didn't have to win. He had to just not lose. And that meant never risking the entire Continental Army in one engagement that might annihilate it. And once he got that insight, now he didn't get it until 1777, and it went against a lot of his own aggressive instincts. It meant that it was a war of attrition, and time and space were on the American side. To try to make an analogy to he led an insurgency, and he came to the realization that an occupying military force, even though it was the most powerful military and economic power in the world, could not succeed if the bulk of the indigenous population didn't want it there. And that has some echoes for us in Iraq right now.
Hmm. Other questions? Let's go to Champaign for line number one. Hello.
Yes. Several years ago, there was a book out called George Washington's Expense Account. Are you familiar with
yeah.
that? Yes?
Yes, it's true.
It is true. Well, okay, I'm calling because my husband read it and has since looked at it occasionally and said, I can't believe this. Is it, you know, are these things really true?
Yeah, well, I'm not sure what your... Washington, when he assumed command of the Continental Army in June of 1775, said he would serve without salary.
Yes.
But that he would expect the Continental Congress to pay his expenses.
Uh-huh.
And let me tell you,
he
made elaborate accounting, and they spent tons of money on him. I mean, he was very assiduous in insisting that they pay for everything.
Yes.
And so his ultimate pay, if you will, was his expenses, but they were substantial, and because Washington came from way back in the pack, he never had the kind of confidence of a Jeffersonian aristocrat. And therefore, he really paid a lot of attention to money. And he charged virtually everything to the Continental Congress. Now, he was honest about it. I don't think he padded his account. But it is an extremely ornate and lengthy a list of expenses, and when they failed to pay him something towards the end of the war, you know, he went into the Continental Congress and read on the Riot Act. So I think what your husband read is that book, and it's essentially correct.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
All right.
You're welcome.
Let's go to the next caller in Marshall. This is line two. Hello.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to make a couple comments. I read a biography of Martha, and it seemed, as you know, you talked about George giving up this and giving up that and then coming home. I think he really loved his home in Mount Vernon. And he sort of regrouped there and gave him strength.
Absolutely. I mean, he did not want to be president of the United States.
Yeah.
More than any man in American history, he did not want it. And the bulk of his correspondence in the presidency is letters back to Mount Vernon talking about how to run the farms.
Yeah.
That's where he wanted to be, under what he called his vine and fig tree.
And, you know, Martha really put up with a lot from him because she ran the farm a lot, according to this, you know, when he was gone. And didn't she follow him around a lot, you know?
Oh, she did. And, I mean, in every winter campaign during the war, when the Army went into winter quarters, Martha joined Washington,
mm-hmm.
not just at Valley Forge, but in Morristown and all the other places as well.
Yeah.
I think their marriage began as a marriage of convenience, but it grew into a warm relationship.
Yeah.
He was in love with another woman at the very time he married Martha. He was in love with a woman called Sally Fairfax, who happened, excuse me, who happened to be married to his best friend.
She probably didn't have a nice big farm.
He chose Martha because she, you know, because she was the wealthiest widow.
Uh-huh.
But I think their relationship was very close and very warm.
Yeah.
The sadness is that they destroyed their correspondence so that we can't really recover it in the detail that we would like to.
Yeah.
But Mount Vernon was where he wanted to be. And again, if you read his diary, he was happier talking about how to get rid of the Hessian flies,
mm-hmm.
New plow designs, than he was in talking about provisions of the Jay Treaty or foreign policy or anything like that. Guests at Mount Vernon, who came in great numbers after he retired, in both of his early retirements, after the war and then after the presidency, you know, mm-hmm. say when he walked back and forth on the piazza in the back, he preferred to talk about, you know, agrarian issues rather than political issues.
Yeah, that's kind of the idea I got. Well, thanks.
All right, thank
you. You're welcome.
Well, again, we'll go to somebody calling on a cell phone, I believe, here, line three. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I'm enjoying this a lot. Thank you very much.
Sure.
Strikes me that we hear that Washington was sort of the rock of the revolution. It was his determination that sort of kept people focused on doing this and held things together. And likewise, it was Lincoln whose determination held the Union together a little more than half a century later. Can I ask the guest to contrast the two men? Give us an idea of their special characteristics that allowed them to do these remarkable things.
Well, I think that's a big question. I think the three greatest presidents in the United States are Washington, Lincoln, and Franklin Roosevelt. And historians then disagree among those three as to which is the greatest.
Mm-hmm.
I think that Lincoln is more lyrical, more articulate, more profound in some sense.
Mm-hmm.
Lincoln's second inaugural is pure poetry.
Yeah.
And he did face what I think is one of the greatest crises in American history. But I think the Revolution is a greater crisis than the Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
And what Washington did that we need to recover, by the time you get to Lincoln, there is a thing called the American nation, and the question is whether or not it's going to remain a single nation or be split between North and South.
Right.
When Washington is coming to power as general and then as president, the term United States is a plural noun. They didn't say the United States is. They said the United States are.
Yeah.
And he creates and embodies the union, the nation. And he's the singular symbol of that at a time when you got to remember people like Jefferson and Madison believe that we come together as 13 different states to defeat the British Empire, but after the war we should go back to being independent states. Jefferson didn't think he was an American. He thought he was a Virginian. And what Washington does that's so difficult for us to recover is create the expectation that the Revolution is not just about independence, but it's also about nationhood. He has the advantage of being present at the creation, of being there, you know, at the start. And I think in the end, although Lincoln tends to quote Jefferson more than Washington, in the end, Lincoln sees himself as the successor of Washington who's going to insist on the survival of the Union. Does that help?
Yes, it does. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks for the call. How much was Washington involved in politics after concluding his presidency?
Well, he didn't want to be, but he got involved in a mess, and it was his fault partially. It's one of the weaker moments in Washington's career. It's a complicated story, and I won't bore you with all the details, but there's a thing going on called the quasi-war with France, where an undeclared war with France. And there's some fear, exaggerated fear, that the French are going to invade the United States. Now, Adams says that the chance of seeing the French army in America is about as great as seeing a snowball on the streets of Philadelphia in the middle of July. But under the fear of this, Alexander Hamilton pushes forward this plan for the creation of what they call the Provisional Army. And they call on Washington to come out of retirement, to be the sort of titular head of it. It's really a plan by Hamilton to take over the army because he knows that Washington is really not going to come into the field. But Washington supports it. He also supports the Alien and Sedition Acts, which are, you know, a bad moment in American history, because he really does feel that political parties, especially what's then called the Republican Party, is undermining some sort of the Union of the United States. And he never really has to go into the field, but he's party to what is a kind of Hamiltonian conspiracy. And Hamilton plans on taking this 15,000-man army, marching it through Virginia, putting down the Jeffersonians, going all the way to Mexico and setting himself up as an emperor. It's a bizarre scheme. It's somewhat like the scheme of Aaron Burr later. Nothing ever comes of it, and Washington eventually backs away from it, but he's drawn in. See, he's the first ex-president, and in the past, you know, monarchs weren't you're a monarch until you die. And nobody, you know, at that stage of the game, it wasn't quite clear what an ex-president was supposed to do. And I think it was one of the big mistakes in his life to allow himself to be drawn into this scheme.
We have about 15 minutes left. We have some other callers, and we'll just, of course, continue to talk with them and with our guest, Joseph Ellis. His new book is His Excellency George Washington. It's published by Knopf. He's well known as an historian of Revolutionary America. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. The next caller is Crete, and that's line number one. Hello.
I would have thought that the title American Sphinx would have fitted Washington as well as fitted Jefferson. The Whiskey Rebels, that was a pocket issue that really Washington became more than just a pocket issue. It became a cause célèbre in a sense. I think he overdid it as far as a response to that situation. He's often criticized for not freeing his slaves until he died. Jefferson is criticized in a sense by the fact that he was going behind Washington's back, especially in the late 1790s, and
criticizing That's right.
him more specifically than perhaps the public would know. And finally, the father of the country could not be a father himself. Although some would blame Martha, there's a new view that Washington did have children with the Sally Hemings touch to it.
That last thing is almost certainly untrue. There's a little hint of it in a recent book by Henry Wyanchek, but even Wyanchek, having studied it, backs away from that. I think that you're right. I think Washington was almost certainly sterile. He married Martha when she was 29. She had had four children, two of whom survived, and then after they married, she never had any more. On the Jefferson stuff, you've raised a whole bunch of different things, and I'll just try to comment on a few of them, if I may. If you look at what Jefferson does in the 1790s with regard to Washington, it's really duplicitous. He spreads rumors while he's Secretary of State and later on when he's Vice President with Adams, but mostly as Secretary of State, that Washington is senile or becoming senile, but the real power behind the office is Hamilton. He does this because, and it's not true, he does this because Washington is unassailable, and they want to attack the Federalist Party, do Madison and Jefferson, but they know if they attack Washington, you know, he's like the third rail. You touch that and you die. And so their argument is it's really Hamilton running the show. Now, again, that's not true, but allows them to proceed with their own opposition politics. There's lore oral history at Mount Vernon amongst the white members of the Washington family, not the black, that Martha says the toughest day in her life, other than the one that when Washington died, was the day when Jefferson came for a visit. He came down after being elected president. It's only a few miles from Washington to Mount Vernon to pay his respects. And she says, according to this lore, that Washington had told her never to allow that man on the premises again. So the relationship between Washington and Jefferson, which at one point was quite wonderful, really degenerates at the end.
Could we talk, or I would invite you to talk just a bit more about slavery, just because it seems that whenever we talk about these men, it's a key sort of point, and what people continually ask is, how is it that these men, having fought the Revolution and having said everything they said about freedom and liberty, could own slaves? What did Washington think about slavery?
He changes his mind. There's an evolution in Washington. He begins as a Virginia planter, pretty typical, talking about his slaves in the same way they talk about livestock. He's morally numb on the issue. During the war, he's exposed to opinions that he hadn't seen before in Virginia, especially from some people on his staff like Hamilton and Lafayette and Henry Lawrence, all of whom say to him that the values which the Revolution is about are incompatible with slavery. And he comes to understand that and even endorses a plan that doesn't work to free the slaves in South Carolina if they will sign up with the Continental Army for the duration. After the war, he writes several letters, private letters, in which he says that he realizes that slavery needs to end. One of the reasons he thinks that is not moral, but economic. He has experienced firsthand at Mount Vernon the fact that slavery is unprofitable. He thinks Virginia should go from tobacco to wheat and grains, and instead of being the northern outpost of the South, should be the southern outpost of the North, more like Pennsylvania, and that slavery is simply not a profitable labor source. He also distrusts purely moral arguments about slavery. Several different Quakers see him in his retirement and in his presidency and say that he needs to step forward and take a leadership issue here. And he says to them, "Where were you when I needed you during the war? You were all pacifists. If I'd listened to you then, we'd all still be subjects of the British Empire." I think the way to sum it up is, if you want to compare Washington to our modern 20th and 21st century racial and multicultural values, you're going to be disappointed. On the other hand, if you want to compare him to his peers, he looks very good indeed. He's the only prominent member of the Virginia dynasty to free his slaves in his will. He knows he needs to make a statement there, and he does it in part because he knows that this will be a stain on his reputation unless he at least demonstrates a commitment to the principle of emancipation. He actually also sets up an endowment to cover the expenses and the education of the freed slaves for the next 25 years. And there's a law in Virginia saying that freed slaves have to leave the state after a year, but nobody's going to enforce that law against Washington slaves, and so that most of them stay around Mount Vernon.
Let's get back to callers here, and I think our next person up in line would be a caller in Urbana, line number two. Hello.
Yeah, hi. I know that, we all know that there was a long history of breaking treaties with the Indians, and I was wondering, did that start in Washington's time? And if so, was he complicit in it, or what was his attitude toward treaties as supreme law?
It's an important question. I think one of the more original or at least freshest things in this book I've written is to make the case that Washington devoted more time and energy to the issue of Native Americans than he did to any other domestic issue in his first and second term. Washington thought of Indians as equals and said on several occasions that if he was in their position, he'd be doing exactly what they were doing, attempting to defend their own homeland. He thought that what eventually came to be, namely the movement of all the Indians, Indian removal under Jackson, was was a tragedy that should never happen. And what he wanted to do is establish federal jurisdiction over Indian reservations or enclaves. The treaties were treaties with foreign powers. These were separate nations, and they should have federal jurisdiction behind them. But he couldn't enforce it because the states refused to allow that to happen, especially Georgia and South Carolina. And the last thing he wrote as president was an open letter to the Cherokee Nation, saying, if you will abide by the terms of this treaty, I, the Great White Father, tell you that you will be protected. It's the singular failure of his presidency and the one he most deeply regretted. There are certain letters from Washington to his Secretary of War, Henry Knox, that have that sound like cultural anthropologists talking about the need to preserve the Indian mores. He foresaw a time that over a century we would keep these enclaves of tribal culture protected, and then over a century they would eventually be assimilated into the American population. But of course, it didn't work that way.
All right, Southern LaSalle County is next, line three. Hello.
Thank you, Cindy. Parents would like to be interested in this. My classmate and I, the years that the Cubans came into Florida, we took two girls, 10 and 11, to Mount Vernon. We took it because there was a gentleman that was retired that has his own little escort service. It was wonderful to go there. But what I really want to tell you, it probably is 1944, my dad took all of us through the 13 colonies, and he went to Fraun's Tavern, I think it's by Battery Park and Wall Street, and I think we saw a set of teeth. And the other little item is my mother always was very good on vocabulary, but when we got down around Pittsburgh, she called it Duquesne, and my dad corrected her. Thanks.
I don't have anything to say. It sounds like you've had some interesting experiences, though.
All right. We'll go to Farmer City then, line number four. Hello.
Yes, good morning, and thank you. Do you have any knowledge of Washington's acquaintance with or association with Captain George Prince during the Revolution?
No.
Okay.
Maybe I should.
Well,
who is George Prince?
Well, he supposedly was a member of his staff or one of his advisors, I've been told. I'm doing some research on him, and I'm having difficulty finding information about him.
Hmm. Well, I didn't know that.
He's not a to you.
I mean, the major members of his staff are Lawrence, Lafayette, and Hamilton. There's a big staff, and one of the problems you have is when you're reading the correspondence of Washington during the war, you're not sure whether he wrote it or somebody else wrote it. Most of the time, somebody else wrote it. He did have a loyal slave with him, Billy, they call him, and who went throughout the war with him. And then there's a couple of pictures of him with a kind of Sultan's hat on, and in his will, he freed Billy right away for his service during the war. Again, we'd love to know, and every morning, Billy combed his hair and da-da-da-da-da-da, but this Prince person you're talking about, I don't know anything about.
Okay. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
All right. All right. Well, sorry we can't do better than that. We're coming down here the last couple of minutes. I'm interested. You talked earlier about the fact that at Mount Vernon, they're engaged in trying to use contemporary forensic science and so forth to develop some images. And I think they're actually talking about three-dimensional images of Washington
right.
So that people could almost, like, walk up and see what it would be like to have met Washington, particularly when he was a young man, since mostly we have these images when he was older. Is that something, do you think, how meaningful is that to be able to come up and look at a wax figure of the young George Washington?
Well, you know, it's controversial. Jim Reese, the guy that heads Mount Vernon, has come under some criticism for what the critics would call the Disneyification of Mount Vernon. I tend to disagree, and I'm a historian, a scholar, a PhD and all that stuff, but I really think that to the extent that we want to involve the public in an understanding of our history, we've got to use the kind of technology that they're used to. And in the case of Washington, recovering an image of him as a young man fundamentally transforms your sense of who he was and gives you a very different notion of what American history was like back then. So I support Jim Reese's efforts there, and I don't think that they're just playful. I think that their attempts to use modern technology to recover portions of the past which are otherwise lost.
Well, we're going to have to stop, and certainly there's much more in the book for people if you would like to read it, Dan. It's not a particularly long book, and one of the things that our guest, Joseph Ellis, says, he set out trying not to write a very, very long book. But
I don't like books when you put them on your knee, they break your kneecap.
Well, you know? You wouldn't want that. And it's a book that particularly concentrates, as he's interested in, concentrating on Washington's character and trying to understand him. So the book is His Excellency George Washington, published by Knopf, by our guest, Joseph Ellis. You might also look at his book, American Sphinx, which is a biography of Thomas Jefferson, and his book, Founding Brothers, that won him the Pulitzer Prize. And Mr. Ellis, thank you very much for talking with us.
David, it's been my pleasure.